Welcome back. Here is our third presentation for Chapter 4. Now, before we get started, I want you to go to the class website and find the Mutual Fund Scramble Sheet. And you can print it out or have it on the screen. But what we do in the face-to-face class is we build this thing on the whiteboard as we're going through the presentation. And we see the spectrum, if you will, the broad range of the most aggressive mutual funds all the way to the least aggressive. And I thought, well, you can't really do that in an online class, so what should I do? So I created it as a sheet of paper and then posted it on the website, and then I thought, well, this is kind of cool, and I now print it out for my face-to-face students, because some of them aren't the best note takers, and sometimes it's very difficult to understand what the professor is trying to build before you've even seen it. So now it works. I think it works pretty well. And realizing that this is just a sampling, these are the most important ones, but they're not all the different categories of mutual funds. Getting started on slide 39, we start with the most aggressive funds, and those, of course, are stock funds, and they are the most aggressive stock funds. They are called aggressive growth funds. Highly speculative mutual funds that seek large profits from capital gains. And what I like to say is they is rolling the dice, folks. They are really just trying to create eye-popping returns by sometimes called momentum trading or aggressive trading. They go by other names. Some fund companies now have a category or two more speculative than aggressive growth, ultra funds or momentum funds. And one of the biggest examples was a fund, I'm not sure, I guess it's still around, it's called Janus 20. Now, Janus is the name of the mutual fund company. They're based in Denver. And the mutual fund is called 20. If you remember in our first presentation, we said that the Investment Company Act of 1940 says that no mutual fund can invest more than 5% of their assets into any one security, stock or bond. So if you put 5% into 20 different items, that's 100%. So Janus 20 was basically saying, we're going to be a mutual fund that doesn't do diversification. We're going to concentrate in as few securities as we're legally allowed to do so, and that's 20 stocks. It was a great stock mutual fund while the market was going up, and right. So my advice to you folks is, you know, lay off of these things. It's up to you. It's your money. But sure, some of them are going to do really, really well. You can win big. But what do we know about greater return? We're going to accept greater risk. You can lose big. And an analogy I use, which I don't know if you like it or not. If you don't like it, don't just ignore me. But I like to think of aggressive growth funds and their counterparts, growth funds, as spice. Spice. If you're at a buffet, do you load up your plate with jalapeno peppers and habaneros and, well, maybe some of you do. My son does. But most, no! You're going to get burned doing that. You put a little bit of spice in your mix. And so that's what I suggest to you. Put a little bit of aggressive growth funds in your 401k allocation. Because you may say to yourself, I know that as long as I have a long-term perspective, I'm going to put everything into aggressive growth funds and deal with the volatility. But when the market drops 20, 30, 40, 50%, as it does every, you know, so often, will you have the stomach to stay in the game and put more money in? My experience watching people is that you know, they really started to run for the exits, especially when their fund, everybody else's fund has gone down 30%, their fund down went down 60%. Right, because it was aggressive growth. So go ahead, put a little bit of spice in your mix, but not a whole lot. Of course, you have to decide what you're going to do. The next category down is growth funds. The Mieser mutual funds whose primary goals are capital gains and long-term growth. They typically invest in high-growth companies, while at the same time probably not trading, or hopefully not trading, as much as their aggressive growth counterparts. But they're lumped in together with one another. So this spice is not quite as hot as the aggressive growth. Slide number 40. We have another category called capital appreciation. Now you read on slide number 40 that these mutual funds seek long-term growth of capital. Well, okay. How does that differ from a growth fund or an aggressive growth fund? And what I did on the scramble sheet is try to show that capital appreciation funds are associated with aggressive growth and growth funds by writing capital appreciation around growth funds and aggressive growth funds, and try to write upside down, folks. It's not easy. These capital appreciation funds are more flexible. Most growth funds or aggressive growth funds in the prospectus will have a provision that states that they will invest primarily in growth stocks, usually staying between 80% and 100% invested in the market. Whereas most capital appreciation funds can invest in anything they like and anywhere they like. So they're far more flexible. They paint with a broad brush. Does that make any sense? If they saw a cyclical company or a defensive company that they thought was a good value and had the opportunity for appreciation for the price to go up, they could invest in those. Now, we're throwing around terms like defensive and cyclical and blue. We didn't say blue chip, but blue chip. And what are these things? Well, there's something we're going to learn about in Chapter 5 when we get to stocks. So that's one of the problems, as we said, of putting mutual funds before stocks. But we need to deal with mutual funds first, I believe. So we're going to deal with that by saying these capital appreciation funds can often invest in different types of companies, not just growth companies. And one of the most well-known capital appreciation funds was Fidelity's Magellan Fund. It was run by a gentleman by the name of Peter Lynch, and we'll come back to him, from 1977 to 1989, and Peter Lynch racked up 29% a year. Wow, yeah, and he did it in the most unassuming way. He would invest everywhere. He just had such an eclectic. That means everything. Eclectic means you don't prefer just one thing. You like everything. I mean, he invested in anything from Volvo to Dunkin' Donuts. He loved Taco Bell, and he did really, really well. And part of the reason. Was that he fit that anywhere, anything, mold. He was really well suited to running a capital appreciation fund. Okay, great. And you see the scramble sheet, how it's wrapped around there. What in general happens is they tend to be about as risky as growth and aggressive growth funds. So and of course every fund is different, so you have to look at its track record and its management and all that. Slide number 41. Let's now slide down the risk versus reward spectrum with regard to stocks and take a look at my personal favorite, and that's called growth and income funds. These are mutual funds that seek both long-term growth, yes, we want growth from stocks, but we also want current income. normally the primary emphasis is on capital gains, but not always. And so what do we get when we invest in stocks? If you go back to chapter one, remember the two big things? We get dividends and capital gains. Well, that's growth. Capital gains are growth, and dividends are income. So these mutual funds will balance the two. They will say, look, we want stocks that are growing, yes, but we also want stocks that pay dividends. Some people refer to these as blend mutual funds, a blend of growth and value. So you'll see that term, and you see that I've written blend around growth and income. And often associated with, but not always the same, is the category value funds. Value funds are mutual funds that seek stocks that are undervalued in the market by investing in shares that have low PE multiples and high dividend. What are you talking about? Relax. We'll discuss this in chapter 5. But in other words, they're looking for companies that are out of favor, that are poo-pooed, that are avoided by the market. And they are often lumped together with growth and income funds. But you have to be careful. Some are traditional growth and income funds that they look for companies for growth and they look for companies for income, and they're often called blend funds. And then some are strictly value funds that look for companies that are way out of favor, sometimes you hear people say they look for deep value. They look for companies that have a lot of value. They call it deep value. And continuing our analogy of the buffet, this is the pasta. This is the meat and potatoes. This is what you put the most of on your plate. Okay? So especially you do that because you're a professor. No. And if I ask you what would you use for a recommendation for a client or you for yourself, if you stick with growth and value, you'll always make growth and income. I'm sorry, you'll make me very, very happy. But that does, that's up to you. So you got that? That's the pasta. That's the meat and potatoes. That's the main dish. The next category in our stock group are equity income funds. Equity income is a term that we use so that we in the industry look as though we know more than you outside the industry. And equity means stock, and income means dividend. So wouldn't it be nice if they just called them stock dividend funds? No, they can't. It's too easy. We have to call them equity income funds. And these are mutual funds that emphasize current income and capital preservation by investing primarily in high-yielding, income-producing common stocks, or corporations' common stocks. And these are companies that are boring. Railroads, foods, utilities, REITs, real estate investment trusts. Right, these are companies that aren't going anywhere, folks. They're not growing very fast, certainly, but they're not going to disappear overnight because some new technology came out. And what these companies are doing is, what these mutual funds are doing, is they are looking to earn their keep from the dividends. Yeah, if the stock price goes up, great. We're happy. Well, we'll take some capital gains, but we're mostly looking for income from stocks. And some of them will also invest in bonds, in interest-generating devices, fixed income securities, to generate income when the investment advisor believes that stock prices have risen to levels that threaten the preservation of capital. In other words, don't lose the money. Many equity income funds did very well during the 2000 to 2002 bear market after lagging the market badly during the late 1990s technology-driven bull market. Yeah, you see, nobody wanted railroads or food companies. They were called old economy. I know some of you were a little young for this, but it was 14 years ago, and these were called old economy stocks. No, but I'll never forget this woman, potential investor, telling me, "Well, a REIT? Why would you invest in a REIT? no one's going to be going to grocery stores anymore. You'll get all your food through the internet. And I thought, lady, if that ever happens, it's not for many, many years. And probably what'll happen is it'll just be a mixture of both. But whatever. So these things held up very well during the 2000 to 2002 downturn, because technology got destroyed. What happened in 2008? Yeah, right, they got clobbered too. But if you go back and look, you'll see that the equity income funds still held up better than the growth, the aggressive growth, and even the growth in income funds. Aggressive growth funds went down 50, 60, 70%. Yeah, growth funds 50%. The growth in income funds went down 40. The equity income funds went down 30. Well, these are generalizations. Some did better, some did worse. So they're going to hold up better when things go bad, but when things are great, they're sitting in the corner and just sort of doing their thing, and everybody just doesn't even want to talk to them. And so what can we use in our food analogy? Oatmeal. Right, oatmeal. Is oatmeal exciting? No, it's boring. You got to put a lot of cinnamon, a lot of sugar, and to make them exciting, and raisins and bananas or whatever. But is it good for you? You better believe it's good for you, folks. Look what it does for horses, right? Horses eat oats, and look how good they look. So this is our analogy. If it works for you, great. If it doesn't, I apologize. Okay, so that was from the riskiest aggressive growth through growth in income and equity income. Because now we're going to throw another whole other characteristic at you for funds, huh? If you look at the scramble sheet, you'll see there's a line in between equity income and the next three categories. And those categories have to do with how large the company is. Large cap, mid cap, small cap. What are you talking about? Hip-hop, baseball cap? No. CAP stands for capitalization, and we'll discuss that in detail in Chapter 5. But the largest companies are called large cap. The smallest companies are called small cap, and medium or in between, mid cap. Now, which do you think is riskiest? Oh yeah, small cap. The small companies are far riskier because they don't have the wherewithal to withstand serious economic disruptions. The large companies have their roots deep in the economy, and when things go bad, you know, they're not happy about it, and their stock falls, but the small cap stocks get clobbered. Interestingly, when the economy comes back, the small cap come back stronger because, one, they got hit harder, and two, they're more nimble. It's easier for them to respond to changes in the economy, and they can more quickly right their ship, so to speak. The next category we're going to throw at you is the domesticity. Domesticity is a fancy word for where is the company based. And we have three. We discussed this, right, in Chapter 1. You remember this? Domestic means based in the United States. Global means based anywhere in the globe, including the United States. And international, also called foreign, means based outside the United States. So be careful that subtle distinction. Now, what do you think is the riskiest? Well, 50 years ago, the conventional wisdom was that domestic was the least risky, international was much riskier, and global was in between. Well, you know what? Tain't true anymore, folks. It's not true that the risk is outside the United States and the least risk is inside the United States. Companies are global. Some companies are based in the United States. They do more business outside the United States than they do inside the United States. And some companies are based outside the United States and they do a significant, if not the vast majority, of their business inside the United States. So figure that one out. You can't. You have to think globally, in my humble opinion. In my humble opinion. And so what happened is that it became almost like a menu. Pick one from column A and one from column B and one from column C. And so what you would see is somebody would say, ooh, ooh, ooh. And if you look at the scramble sheet, I have the circles It's a global large cap growth fund. Or, it's a domestic small cap aggressive growth fund. And when one mutual fund company created a global large cap growth fund, or a domestic small cap growth aggressive growth fund, they all had to create them. So now do you see how we can wind up with 10,000 different mutual funds? You folks who are taking statistics, ask your professor, what are the permutations? Well, how many different permutations can you come up with all these different categories? A whole bunch. So you see why the industry is just exploded. Because if one company does it, then they all have to do it, because they're all competing with one another. Now, some companies resisted that urge. They just basically said, nuh-uh, we're not going to do it. But they're the exception, not the norm. Now, a couple other categories which are part of the stock world, and those are regional funds. You can buy mutual funds that just invest in Japan, or the Far East, or Latin America, or Canada, or the Nordic countries. Or you understand? These are regional funds. Now, what do you think of that? I'm not a big fan of these. I prefer global. Because what were the two main reasons we bought mutual funds, we invest in mutual funds? Professional money management and diversification. By concentrating your investment in a single region of the world, are you diversifying? No, you're concentrating. Now, if you've been down in Latin America for the last few years and you see, wow, the place is booming, and it is, go ahead, put 5, 10, maybe even 20% of your 401k into a Latin American fund. But even then, I wouldn't do it. Personally, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't recommend people do it. But if you know what area you're discussing in detail, because you happen to live there, you have friends there, and relatives, okay, all right, a little bit. And the same thing is true for emerging markets. India, Mexico, Brazil, Russia, Philippines, China, Turkey, these countries are experiencing tremendous growth. Well, it makes sense, right? They've downloaded our apps. They've seen how well the West has done. And so now they're saying, me some too! And they're doing very well. It's a whole lot smaller base that they're starting from. So when we say that China and Mexico and India have grown 7-8%, it's a smaller base, but it's becoming certainly in my humble opinion, the next engine of world economic growth. But still, there's a reason why these are sometimes called submerging markets. Right, they're far more volatile. So again, would you fill up your plate with these? No, a little bit, 10-20%, but certainly not 100%. And then there are two other types of mutual funds that I hope you'll avoid. Sector funds. These are funds that invest just in one sector of the economy, energy, or wireless, or technology. And of course, there are several subcategories of technology. Healthcare, and there are several subcategories of healthcare, and paper products, and leisure activities, and mining activities, utilities. And again, we buy a mutual fund for diversification. When you buy a sector fund, are you diversifying? No, you're concentrating. So if you know something about that sector because you happen to work in it, you're in Montana and South Dakota and Wyoming and seeing that the energy drilling companies are just exploding, yeah, go ahead, put 5-10% of your funds in there. But for the most part, I would avoid them. Those are my personal opinions. They are, for whatever they're worth, you decide what you're going to do. And then the last group is called market timing. And folks, I got to tell you, this is dumb. This is really dumb. All the statistics, we'll come back to market timing. All the studies have shown that people, you can't do it. You can't time the market. So if you have the gall, if you're a money manager, to call your mutual fund a market timing fund, and anybody actually believes you, well then, more power to you. I hope you do well. I don't think you will, but I have this quote somewhere in the slides in the future. You'll see. Don't try to time the market. It can only be done by liars. people who lie to you or they lie to themselves. Now, that was the left side, the stock side of the scramble sheet. Now let's take a look at the right side, the bond side, the fixed income side. And again, we're going to go from the highest risk down to the lowest risk. Bond funds, fixed income funds, fixed funds, are mutual funds that invest in various kinds and grades of bonds with primary income normally as the primary objective. And the most riskiest bond funds are called high yield or high income bond funds. What's a better name or a more popular name? Junk, and we'll get to that when we get the bonds. But the interesting part about high-yield bond funds is that they are often more correlated with stocks than they are with bonds. Huh? Well, we'll discuss the correlation between stocks and bonds and the relationship between stocks and bonds. But high-yield bonds are bonds normally invested in companies that are in trouble. They have to pay much higher interest rates, just as somebody who has really bad credit has to pay higher interest rates. These companies have to pay really high interest rates. And if the economy is doing well, the stock market's going to do well, so stock funds will do well, but the companies are going to do well, and so the belief that they're going to default on their interest payments goes down, right, exactly. So the bond funds do really well. So they often follow stock funds. Exactly. If the stock funds go up, the junk bond funds will go up. If the stock funds go down, the junk bonds will go down. Junk bond funds will go down, which is counter to what the rest of the bond fund world will do. The next group are the corporate bond funds. Sometimes included with them are convertible bonds, and doesn't that sound exciting? A convertible? No, it's not. We'll get to that when we get to preferred investments, hybrid investments. But corporate bond funds normally invest in bonds that are issued by corporations that have very good credit. So do you believe that Walmart's going to stop making its payments on its interest? No. Or large companies such as GE? No. They're going to pay their interest payments. The next group are muni bonds and insured muni bonds. You can actually buy muni bonds that are insured by an insurance company. These are very popular with high net worth individuals. And why is that? As we will learn in detail when we get to bonds, municipal bonds that are issued by states and local government cities and school districts and bridge authorities, water authorities, these bonds are free from federal income tax. And if you buy bonds from your state, we're in California, so if you bought a California bond fund, not only would you not pay federal income taxes on the interest, you would also not pay any California interest. So why are these popular with high net worth individuals? Because they pay high taxes. Well, for you and me, they're not that great a deal because we don't need the tax break. But for people in the higher tax brackets, oh boy, are they popular. And we'll see why once we get to bonds, describe and can calculate the interest that we get, the rate of return we get, depending on how much taxes we pay. The next group are the U.S.-backed bonds. Now, these are not bonds from the United States government. They are bonds from entities where there is an explicit or implicit, meaning a spoken or unspoken, backing from the U.S. government. You may have heard of Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. Fannie Mae is not a candy company, folks. It's a mortgage company, but you don't go to Fannie Mae to get a mortgage. Your mortgage company goes to Fannie Mae to sell your mortgage, and Fannie Mae turns it into a bond and sells it all around the world. What are you talking about? Relax. We'll get to it. And Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and a couple other entities like them were sponsored by the United States Congress. So for many years, there was an implicit, meaning unspoken, there was an implicit belief that if things did not go well with these companies, the federal government would step in. And for decades, the federal government, the representatives, the Congress and the like said, no way, they're private entities, we're never going to... 2008 came along, the housing bubble burst, the bonds that were based on the mortgages that were issued for all these houses that were twice what they should have been, the price fell apart, and the United States government now owns Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Did all the bond investors, were they made whole? Yes, they were. Because of you and I, the taxpayer. And then the last group. The most, I don't care what anybody says, the federal government is not going to default. Unless it's a political default. Unless, you know, the Republicans and the Democrats can't agree on something. But no, we're going to pay our bills. The government bond funds, also called treasury bond funds or treasury funds or government securities funds or government funds, invest in bonds that are issued by the full faith and credit of the United States government. And interestingly, as the muni bonds were free from federal income taxes, treasury bonds are free from state and local income taxes. Very interesting how it's called the reciprocity. I hope I said that right. Reciprocal clause of the Constitution. The feds can't tax the states and local governments, and the states and local governments can't tax the feds. Now, on top of that, from the highest risk to the lowest risk spectrum, we're going to overlay, again, two other categories. Long-term, intermediate-term, short-term bond funds. Now, you may be tempted to think long-term, that's L, large cap. Short term, S, small cap. And intermediate term is kind of like mid cap. No, nothing. They have nothing to do with one another. Don't get confused. It turns out that the short term bond funds are the least risky. The long term bond funds are the most risky, but carry the opportunity for greater reward. And why is that? Well, it has to do with lending money. Think of yourself as a bank. When you're lending money out to people for 6 months, or 5 years, or 15 or 30 years, the longer you lend the money out, the more chances for things to go wrong. So, in general, you're going to charge more if you're going to have the money out there for a longer time. But there's going to be less of a chance for things to go wrong if you lend the money out for a shorter period of time. And that's the same thing true for bond funds. And then again, the domesticity. Is it domestic? Is it global? Is it international? So on the right-hand side of the scramble sheet, we see, oh, this one is a domestic, long-term, high-yield bond fund. You see? Pick one from column A and one from column B and one from column C. Okay, let's continue. Now, we said we're going from the riskiest to the least riskiest, and we include in this continuation of this discussion, this continuation of the different types, balance funds. These mutual funds have the objective to generate a balanced return of both current income and long-term capital gains. They invest in both stocks and bonds, and normally the allocation will be 60% stocks, 40% bonds, but it can change as the investment environment changes and the advisor decides what they think is more attractive at any one time. But most of the good balance funds will stay balanced. And one of the nation's oldest balance funds is called the American Balance Fund. How's that for a generic name? The prospectus states that the fund is managed as the complete U.S. investment program of a prudent investor. In other words, you don't know what to buy on the stock side. You don't know what to buy on the bond side. You buy a bond fund, and then you get some stocks, and you get some bonds, and for example, this one, they will never be more than 75% stocks, 25% bonds, or less than 50% stocks, 50% bonds. So they will keep that balance, so to speak. And you may say, well, I showed it in the scramble sheet. I had them in between. But you might say, well, doesn't that mean that they're less risky than stock funds and more risky than bond funds? Well, it depends on how you define risk and how you measure risk. It turns out that by adding stocks and bonds together, you actually wind up with an investment that exhibits less risk. Huh? Well, it has to do with a discussion that we will make much later, and that's correlation. But if you think of it just for a moment here, stocks and bonds often move in two different directions. Stocks go up, bonds often go down. Bonds go up, stocks go down. That's not always the case. Sometimes they go up together, and in 2008 they went down together. But in general, that's been the history. So by blending the two, you actually wind up with something that has less risk, as measured by standard deviation, which is an imperfect measurement to begin with. Sound cool? So if you really are worried, if you really are scared of stocks, and you're young, and you have to make a decision for your 401k, a balanced fund is a pretty darn good choice, folks. It will exhibit less volatility. It should. There are no guarantees. But it should exhibit less volatility. At the same time, you'll get some growth and you'll get some income. Now, slide number 47. Be careful because you will see a category called asset allocation funds. And some people call balanced funds asset allocation funds, and some people call asset allocation funds balanced funds. So they get lumped in together. But at their in theory, they are very different. These are asset allocation funds are mutual funds that spread investors' money across stocks, bonds, and cash and money market securities. They're very similar to balanced funds. However, the investment advisor often more diligently tries to fine-tune the allocation as market conditions change. Whereas a balanced fund will usually stay about 60-40, or as we saw, the American balanced fund, no more than 75 stocks, 25% bonds, no less than 50% stocks, 50% bonds. An asset allocation fund manager might try to move money into cash when they thought that the market might fall, or move it all into stocks, or move it all into bonds. This is not what I want from a balanced fund, and I suggest to you that unless you know what you're doing and that's exactly what you want, I would stay away from these personally. And I tell you my biases up front so you know them. For all their hype, the returns of many asset allocation funds are pretty close to balanced funds, but some trail the balanced funds considerably because they timed the market badly. They said, hey, it looks really awful, get out of stocks, get out of bonds, just in time for the market to go up 40%, and then they say, okay, time to get back in, just in time for the market to go down 20%. Yeah, don't try to time the market. It can only be done by liars. Slide number 48. And then the very least riskiest mutual fund is a money market mutual fund. Now, this is reviewed because we discussed this in Chapter 1. Mutual funds that invest in short-term money market instruments, such as treasury bills, corporate paper, bankers' acceptance notes, they are very similar to the money market accounts at banks and credit unions, but I think we've said this, right? Are money market mutual funds guaranteed? No, they are not guaranteed by the full faith and credit of the federal government. Haha, yes, they are when times go bad. There are general purpose, there are government securities, they only invest in treasury bills, and then there are tax exempt. How do they get that? Well, what they do is they invest in municipal securities, municipal bonds, that are going to be redeemed in 3, 6, 9 months, so they wind up looking like a corporate paper for a city. Later. We'll get to that later. But remember, your bond is eventually going to be redeemed, and if it's going to be redeemed in 3 months, then it turns out looking just like a treasury bill or a corporate paper, and you get to say, the interest is tax tax-free from federal income. The mutual funds, as we said, are essentially as safe as guaranteed money market accounts, since they invest exactly the same securities, but they're not guaranteed until the organic matter hits the ventilating device, as it did in 2008, and then the Federal Reserve Bank rushes in and says, whoa, back 'em, relax, don't take off your shoes, don't run out the door, don't run around, scream and holler, and take all your money out of your money market. We will make sure that you are whole. And they did that for 6 months, and then they did it again for 6 months, and now they said, okay, the world has not ended, so don't worry. If you're interested in the dynamic, how the whole process happens, what I would suggest you do is go to any internet search engine and type in breaking the buck, because that's exactly what happens. These things are designed to always stay at a dollar, so they look like a checking account. They work like a checking account, and they then pay you interest. But what happens if they goof up? And in 2008, a couple of them had invested in Lehman Brothers short-term securities, and they wound up, one lost a cent, breaking the buck, and went from a dollar to 99 cents, and the other one lost 3 cents. That one did really badly. But what often happens is the company says to the federal regulators, we screwed up. Is it okay if we take our money and put it into the mutual fund so that our investors don't lose any money? And the regulators say, no problem. And if they don't have the money, their competitors will swoop in and say, you goofballs, what are you trying to do? Give us all a bad name? And they'll, throw the money in there because they don't want people to think that these money market accounts are not safe. You see how the industry works? Yeah. So check out Breaking the Buck. Now, let's continue. Where are we? Hello, what's going on? Page 10. Okay, here we are. Specialty funds. Oh, boy. Ah, stay away from these things. Slide number, 50? Hedge funds. Hedge funds are legally not mutual funds. And traditionally, they were only open to sophisticated accredited investors, which meant you had to have $1 million in assets or $200,000 per year in income or be on some board of directors somewhere. But now they're available to people with as little as $5,000 or $10,000. There is no regulatory oversight for these things. They've become a major force, and they every few years they say, we need to regulate these things, and the industry's got lots of good connections with lots of money, and they say, oh, no, you don't. Oh, no. They charge really high fees, and they take 20% of your profits. So they're not something I hope you will ever get involved with. If you do, I wish you lots of luck. I certainly will not be there with you. But if you want to call me and cry on my shoulder, I'll be there. Maybe, who knows? Maybe you'll do really well. Bear funds. Bear funds? Yeah, these are mutual funds that try to do well when the market goes down. Figure that one out? Wait till we discuss shorting. It's dangerous. Stay away from them. Sure, they do well when the world ends, but how often does the world end? And then you can invest in mutual funds that actually invest in gold and other hard assets. This wasn't allowed just a few years ago, but now they're getting away with it. REIT funds are mutual funds that invest in real estate investment trusts. So it's a way to invest in real estate without having to become a landlord. The problem, I like REITs, don't get me wrong, but the problem is there's just not that many of them. So the mutual fund is really concentrated. It's like a sector fund. But it's a great way to invest in real estate if you don't want to be a landlord. And then, dear students, there are literally hundreds of what are called boutique, or sometimes called exotic funds. You cannot make this stuff up, folks. There's a mutual fund called the Stock Car Stocks Funds. And you might think, what do they invest in? NASCAR. Because I have a hard time believing this, but the number one spectator sport in the United States is not football, it's NASCAR. And these people are serious about their NASCAR. If Folgers is the official coffee of NASCAR, or Nextel is the official cell phone of NASCAR, that's the product they have to buy. How about the Paws Tombstone Fund? Paws is the name of the mutual fund company. Tombstone is the name of the fund. Paws? What do they invest in? Pizza? No, not Tombstone Pizza. They invest in mortuaries and cemeteries. Well, everybody's going to die, and thankfully so did the Paws Tombstone Fund. And this one, folks, I cannot make this up. Folks. I can't. The Chicken Little Growth Fund. There was a fund that was called the Chicken Little Growth Fund because of people who were afraid that the sky is falling. The sky is falling. Look it up, because you'll see a whole bunch of other ones. There was one, I'm not sure if it's still in business, called the Timothy Fund. That was for people who were Christian, good Christian folks. And there's the Paul's letter to Timothy, something about, you know, being a good capitalist or something. So check it out. Fact is far stranger than fiction. You can't make this stuff up. The choices are endless, and so are the fees. Time to relax, stretch a little bit, because now we need to talk about index funds. Because, folks, these things are a potent force in the industry. And remember, the other term for index fund is passively managed, because you're not doing any decision making. These are mutual funds that buy and hold a portfolio of stocks or bonds equivalent to those in a specific market index. So no active management is performed, no research. The mutual fund simply buys all the stocks in the Standard & Poor's 500, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the Russell 2000. What are these things? These are lists that we'll discuss in detail in Chapter 5. Why do they do this? Well, as we saw in the previous presentation, they can offer much lower annual fees because they're not doing any research. And it turns out that many actively managed mutual funds don't beat their respective market index, their benchmark index. They don't. If a mutual fund is designed to match the Standard & Poor's 500, or that's their universe of stocks that they pick from, often they don't do it. They don't beat the S&P 500. Sometimes they do, but often they don't. And because of the annual fee, as we saw in the previous presentation, an index fund cannot actually match the market's performance, but it should come very close, providing the annual fee is not excessive, which is up to you to determine what excessive is. And you should be able, from what we saw last presentation, you should be able to see what is excessive and what is not as excessive. And you'll see, I haven't gotten up there yet, but I'll have a presentation describing the Southwestern College 403B plan. Whereas, folks, an actively managed fund could substantially outperform or underperform the market index. And we saw the Legg Mason Value Trust, which substantially outperformed the index for a long time and then substantially underperformed the index. Yes. Okay. Slide number 51. As we said in the previous presentation, the rationale for index funds came from research done in the early 1970s that statistically showed that many of the actively managed funds did not beat their market index. A monkey throwing darts at a dartboard is what they would say. You couldn't do better than a monkey throwing darts at a dartboard. Oh yeah? Well, when they when they did the test, sometimes they didn't do better than sometimes they did do better than the monkey. However, there are many actively managed funds that do beat their respective indices over time. And as an investor, my suggestion, my recommendation is to look for a fund family, and we'll discuss those in the next presentation, where most all funds have consistently beaten their indexes over decades. And it turns out there's only a few major companies, folks. In the late 1990s, index funds became a victim of their own success. Now, I'm a heretic, and I'm not adverse to showing people where the perfect investment is not perfect. The conventional wisdom has flaws. Nothing is perfect. I hope you have figured that out yet. we're human. We make mistakes. Here are just some of the indices. And don't worry about these, folks. The only one you really should remember is the Standard & Poor's 500. But what's going to happen is as you do your annual report, your mutual fund annual report, depending on which mutual fund you'll choose, you're going to see them describe their respective benchmark index. Some just use one index. Some use two or three indices, depending on what the mutual fund is trying to do. And there are countless index funds now. They're just everywhere. They're now the current perfect investment. And for the fail-safe superlative treatment, visit IFA.com, Index Fund Advisor. What, if any, are the downsides? Well, I'm going to show you one on slide 54. What happens, folks, is indexes sometimes become skewed. And what does the word skewed mean? Moved in one direction as opposed to broad movement. They overweighted, if you will. There's a little bulge somewhere. They can become skewed toward a particular sector of the economy or region of the world. Now, I'm going to show you this slide 54, and you're not going to understand it, but that's okay. We're going to come back to it later on when we understand what PE means. But the two examples we use are the Morgan Stanley Capital International. Do I have to remember that? No. EFA, MSCI EFA, Europe, Australia, and the Far East Index, and the Standard & Poor's 500, the largest 500 companies in the United States. At the end of the 1980s, Japan stock market had exploded, folks. Most of you weren't born yet, but you don't remember when the Americans literally thought that Japan was going to take over the world. And there was a song, "I'm Turning Japanese," because all the Japanese products were flooding the market. Sound familiar? Right, except now it's China. And the Japanese market had just gotten to the point where it was so expensive. And how do we measure expense? We're measuring expense by PE, price to earnings ratio. And you don't know what PE is. You will in Chapter 5 and then Chapter 6, and we'll come back to it over and over and over again. But you thought that you were buying the famed international index, the EFA, the Europe, Australia, and the Far East. For many years, that was the most popular international index. In 1989, what you were really doing was buying 60% Japan and 40% Europe, Australia, and everybody else in the Far East, like Hong Kong and Singapore and those entities. Because Japan had gotten so large that it was eating up 60% of the EFA. Japan's stock market hit, I think, 37,000 or 38,000, and then promptly fell to 8,000. What is it now? It's about 11,000, I think. Exactly. So you bought at the worst possible time, thinking that you had a broad index, when actually you bought 60% Japan with a very high valuation. That's what PE stands for, valuation, basically. We'll get to it later on. That's why we'll come back to this slide later on. And then in the year 2000, for 15 years, 18 years in a row, the S&P had just exploded. It had done 14% or 15% for 15 years in a row. In the last 10 years, it had done 18%. I mean, you thought this was the cat's meow. This is what I'm going to get rich, and I'm going to invest in the S&P 500 in March of 2000 at the height of the bubble. And what you didn't understand is that fully one-third of the S&P 500 was now information technology. And we're talking about the computer companies and the internet companies and the telecommunication companies with a PE of almost 60. And we're going to find out that's very high. Whereas everybody else in the United States, and we're talking energy and healthcare and materials and industrials and you know, just the old economy stocks, were still selling for a relatively high PE of 19, but two-thirds of the S&P 500. So what you were buying, folks, was one-third of a very highly overinflated group of stocks. So index funds are not perfect. Don't let anybody tell you they are. They are great vehicles. Don't get me wrong. Congratulations, Mr. Bogle and Vanguard. You've done well for many of your investors. But as we will learn, we will continue to learn, they ain't nothing perfect, folks. And index funds are no exception. Exchange-traded funds. We've already discussed these, and these are open-end mutual funds that trade like a closed-end fund as a listed security on a stock exchange. They trade like a stock, as does a closed-end fund, but there's no limit to the number of shares. And as we saw in the first presentation, they are becoming very popular. One of the reasons they're becoming very popular is not only because they have cheap, they're like index funds are very inexpensive, they can be bought and sold throughout the day like stocks. Most mutual funds, open-end funds, you don't do this. You only buy them once a day. So some people use them as trading vehicles, day traders and the like, please don't do this. And right now, most ETFs are index funds. They're passively managed index funds. But there now are some actively managed exchange-traded funds, so obviously they're going to have higher annual operating expenses because you have to pay people to make decisions. But the best part of ETFs is they have cool names. That's the best part. Spiders and diamonds and cubes. Huh? Well, spider stands for S&P 500, right? SPY, spider, and diamond, DIA, is the symbol for the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And Q, three Qs or four Qs? I think it's three Qs now. It started out as four Qs. Was the symbol for the NASDAQ, or is the symbol for the NASDAQ, so they call them Qs. So that's my apologies. Slide number 56. Socially responsible funds. All right. Touchy-feely, PC, what are we talking about? These are mutual funds that actively and directly incorporate ethics and morality into the investment decisions. And these started decades ago, folks. This is nothing new. This is not something from the 60s, from the hippie generation. No. There were mutual funds before the term socially responsible became popular that would not invest in alcohol or tobacco. There were several. And that was just because some people, were morally opposed to alcohol and tobacco. And then they moved to companies that pollute. They won't invest in companies that build weapons. They won't invest in companies that build nuclear power plants or destroy the rainforests or exploit their labor. And it's surprising that there are any companies left to invest in. But silliness aside, folks, many socially responsible funds have done quite well for their investors. And why is that? There are many reasons that are posited for the reason. But the one that makes the most sense to me is that many of the high-tech companies are very socially responsible. And of course, that's the part of the sectors of the economy that have grown the most over the last 30-some-odd years. And, of course, you knew it had to happen, right? Socially irresponsible funds? What? Slide 57? Yes, possibly as a backlash to socially responsible funds and their perceived political overtones. There is a mutual fund called the Vice Fund. Folks, I am not making this up. Go check it out, vicefund.com. Yes, you guessed it. They love tobacco and alcohol. The manager says he simply loves Philip Morris and all the other corporate nasties you can think of, gambling and defense firms. And folks, it's actually a small fund with pretty high annual fees. It's a no load. It's done very well for its investors, though. So it turns out that tobacco companies are some of the biggest money-making entities this world has ever seen. So if you are so inclined, and don't worry that you are investing in tobacco, check out the Vice Fund. Slide 58. What is this? This is from your book, and this is actually from the Wall Street Journal. We did not look at all the different sub-subcategories and the sub-sub-subcategories of stocks, and here are just some of them. Now, some of the ones we looked at, such as equity income and emerging markets, are sector funds and the S&P 500 index funds. They're on this list, but then there are some that are not on our list, and because of just the explosion of different mutual funds. You with me? So if you're so inclined, look at the sub categories. So Let's continue on slide number 59. Our last slide is a slide that describes Morningstar's style boxes. And this is from your book, and because Morningstar has upgraded these. You know, I use Morningstar. I look at what they have to say about certain mutual funds, but I really don't trust them. They now agree that part of the reason all the different types of mutual funds exploded was because they created these style boxes, and investors thought they had to have a mutual fund that was in every style box. So you see you have large, medium, and small caps stocks, and then you have value, blend, and growth, or growth and income. And so this company, Morningstar, is a company that analyzes mutual funds, and they design the style box to help investors identify investment alternatives. They say they are just fabulous, and no one I know uses them, and neither do I, and they've upgraded to ownership zones. Well, now instead of a box, they've got an oval, and they say they're even better. Check it out! Don't get me wrong, check it out. I still like Lipper better, and my personal preference is to go to the mutual fund company itself, mutual fund website, and invest and research the funds there. But do check Morningstar out. Do check Lipper out. Part of your assignment is to analyze, research a single or two mutual fund companies using their annual report. And some of the data, you're going to want to go to Yahoo or Bloomberg, and you might want to go to Morningstar. Lipper, you have to pay for. So if you want to check out Lipper, you go to the library. You've heard of libraries, right? Go to the library and check out Lipper's and check out Morningstar's materials there. Okay, so now you're going to go back over this, aren't you? Right, you are, because this is a lot of information, isn't it? But as we see, I hope you see, it's really not that difficult. There's just a lot of information there that you really do need to familiarize yourself with and be able to discuss intelligently with individuals who are also immersed in the industry. Because you're the expert, you're the investment guru now, and your friends, family members, and coworkers are depending on you. In our next and last session on mutual funds, we will discuss mutual fund families, some other aspects of mutual funds, services, and the like, and then we'll take a look at a single individual mutual fund. Okay? How you doing, folks? Study hard, bring honor and glory to Southwestern Community College, and we'll see you in the next presentation.